My name is Michael McCusker. And I was happy to hear that Al Jazeera report on the munitions makers having a bad time. I hope they continue to have a bad time. Well, I'd like to read a couple of things from the Brake family, Robert and Gwen, who live in Ocean Park. They write quite often for the Chinook Observer, and they used to send me stories for the North Coast Times Eagle back in the day. So I'd like to start with Gwen from an article she wrote back in late May for the Observer. Grover Norquist calls the shots, making GOP lawmaking a sham. No tax pledge, cookie-cutter conservative legislation cripple Republican thought. And this is by Gwen Brake. When Grover Norquist addressed 10,000 Republicans at the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, back in February, he openly declared, "We just need a president who can sign the legislation that the Republican House and Senate pass. We don't need someone to think. We need someone who knows how to hold a pen," quote unquote. It is easy to marginalize the role of the president when the Republican Party is in such disarray. Evangelicals, Tea Partiers, Libertarians, Conservatives, Neocons, and a few remaining GOPs struggle to reach consensus on any meaningful public policy. What does seem to bind them together is an unfaltering allegiance to Grover Norquist's pledge. In fact, 96% of the Republicans in Congress swore allegiance to the Norquist "No New Taxes" pledge, most prior to taking the official oath of office. Anyone caught breaking the pledge risks political suicide. So what can we, the people, expect from these new pledges who have just marginalized themselves? Since new legislation is likely to have tax consequences, no is the safe answer. Compromise just means changing the variety of cuts. They study peripheral legislation, get active renaming post offices, or beat the drum for more anti-abortion language in legislation. Marginalizing elected representatives is the political strategy for corporate puppeteers. Behind the scenes, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, is tirelessly cobbling Norquist-sanctioned legislation on a wide variety of social and political issues to rescue their do-nothing Republican counterparts. Funded by conservative kingpins and corporate juggernauts, ALEC is doing the work for both our state and federally elected representatives. Remember in high school, learning how a bill becomes a law? Americans assume that legislators spend long hours meeting with constituents drafting laws that impact some significant swath of the electorate. Not so for Republican lawmakers. Each year, over 1,000 pieces of ALEC's handiwork are presented to state legislators and Congress. State legislatures and Congress. One in five becomes law. ALEC is one-stop shopping for legislators who need a little financial support for their upcoming election campaign, a round of golf and party favors. Trips to ALEC, often funded by taxpayers, provide representatives access to ready-made legislation on every special interest or whim of its corporate members. Since its inception in 1973, over 850 pieces of legislation traced to ALEC have become law. Currently, 2,000-plus Republican state and federal legislators and 12 governors belong to ALEC and pay virtually no dues. Over 100 corporations pay up to $25,000 each for the opportunity to meet directly with legislators. Model legislation is voted on together. Corporations have veto power, and every bill comes with a complete marketing scheme and the money needed to sell it. ALEC is behind most of the horrible legislation in the country. When six newly elected Republican governors began their administrations targeting teacher unions as the sole solution to state budget woes, we see champions of ALEC at work. Governor Scott Walker, fresh from revoking the Equal Pay for Women Act in Wisconsin, has survived his recall for his role in that state's anti-union campaign. In Michigan, entire city governments have been replaced with financial managers operating under emergency management authority established by an ALEC law. ALEC is hollowing out the values of our American culture. Across the country, 1,100 bills challenging women's access to basic reproduction and gun fans and ALEC pushed the Stand Your Ground laws, dubbed the License to Murder statute, in 24 states. But the crown jewels in ALEC's are the voter suppression laws passed in dozens of states that will make it difficult for over 5 million seniors, blacks, and students to vote. Oil barons and billionaire ideologues David and Charles Koch fund ALEC and finance the cash roots, and that's a quote, cash roots, Tea Party campaign initiatives nationwide. Mobilizing for the ALEC agenda, the mission of Americans for Prosperity is simple. Capitalize on the people's suspicions about government. Sell propaganda using unimpeachable sources. Cloak the message in moral righteousness and keep silent about the donors. The Koch brothers have one goal, the dismantling of government for personal gain. That means schools, prisons, utilities, parks, any service that provides for the common good must be siphoned into the private sector to be dismantled and sold for profit. Republicans are making these deals behind closed doors, and they want Mitt Romney, vulture capitalist, quote-unquote, at the helm. Koch brothers and Karl Rove have pledged $500 million in ads opposing Barack Obama's reelection while simultaneously waging war on the commonwealth of this nation. Government's role is to preserve and protect the commons. We need to defend ourselves from the tyranny of greed and pledge to vote a straight Democratic ticket until it ends. Keep our boys and girls clean. And that was from Gwen Brake. And this was in the May 30th Chinook Observer. I updated a skosh by saying that Walker has survived the recall. And of course, just recently, this last week, ALEC has shed some of its supporters. They, for some reason or another, maybe attacks of conscience, have opted out. But ALEC is still immensely powerful, especially with the Kochs running most of it. And now, by her husband, Robert Brake, who is a retired college teacher and freelance writer. Rich man, poor man. Lately, I've been hobnobbing with some really rich people, and I've heard their sad story. So I'm here to defend the 1%, one of our most maligned groups in America. I'm sure you have all heard the scurrilous allegations against those unsung heroes of capitalism. The job creators. They're chastised as avaricious, grasping, greedy, power-mad, heartless, predatory, thieving squeezebags. Picky, picky, picky. But isn't it time we stop demonizing wealthy Americans as predatory pusswads simply because they have a couple of more bucks? I've heard enough scathing condemnation and slanderous stereotyping. Let me set the record straight. Being rich isn't a bed of roses. It's not easy having green, and the well-heeled can't trust anybody. Family members, acquaintances, perfect strangers, shysters, crooks, lawyers, and their most dangerous threat, other rich people. But aren't the affluent just like the rest of us? They put on their Ralph Lauren purple label silk trousers one leg at a time, just like us common clay people. The gas prices they pay for their private jets seem like legalized extortion. They struggle to find reliable household help despite those pesky immigration policies. And scoundrels everywhere plot to take their hard-earned money, even while they create thousands and thousands of jobs for other Americans, mainly lawyers ferreting out loopholes in the tax code. The main problem with being rich is never having enough money, and right now, how many of the wealthy are hurting, what with Wall Street bonus cuts up to 25% in 2011, new regulations, smaller profits, layoffs, and pay cuts. Today, many of the rich are just getting by, having to buy discounted caviar, cancel ski trips to Aspen, eliminate their $7,500 a year memberships at the Trump National Golf Club in Westchester, or is it Worcester? mow their own lawns and walk their own dogs, and yacht maintenance, cosmetic surgery, gold-plated bathroom fixtures, and works of art have become obscenely expensive. One Wall Street hedge fund manager told me he's had to cut back on his $17,000 a year pet care budget for his Labradoodle and Bichon Frise. A crushing setback. And it's rumored that Mitt Romney may have to shelve his car elevator project to transport Ann's Cadillacs. Hardly an uplifting prospect. Yes, it is difficult to be not quite rich enough. How can a mere $350,000 a year salary adequately cover private school tuition for three kids, a Connecticut summer rental, and an upgrade for a 1,200-square-foot Manhattan duplex? And who among the 1% can now afford to buy a $72,000 Lexus LS460L surprise birthday or Christmas gift, complete with a red bow? Yes, American rich people are suffering. The 1% is completely outnumbered, while the gap between the rich and the absurdly rich continues to widen. And let's not forget that the rich have been left out of the recession. So where is their struggle? Many of the suffering rich are devastated by their inability to share the same anguish and hopelessness the rest of the country endures. Some complain that they're cruelly deprived of the true meaning of Christmas, what with all their shopping and party obligations. And many have taken to speaking openly with their chauffeurs and tipping less. So what can we little people do to help our suffering benefactors? After all, the rich have feelings too. I say let's organize a telethon called Rescue the Rich to be aired on November 6th. Include guests, live or on tape, like Donald Trump, Grover Norquist, Paul Ryan, George H.W. Bush, Gordon Gekko, and Mitt Romney, and other greats, near greats, and ingrates. Perhaps we could induce the late billionaire J. Paul Getty's grandson, Paul, to participate and relate some of his famous father's cryptic advice about achieving wealth. 1. Get up early. 2. Work hard. 3. Find oil. Let's solicit some fantabulous auction items like fine jewelry, guns, collectibles, antiques, vintage automobiles, and vacation rentals, and maybe throw in a $200 photo op with Donald Trump or Mitt. Forget about soaking the rich. Just allow them to soak in their jacuzzis while we mount a coordinated effort to help them, working together for the common goal of the rich, having more. Become a Rescue the Rich angel by signing up now and vowing to pledge your support. Donations will be cheerfully accepted. And that was by Robert Brake. And it appeared in the April 18th, 2012 Chinook Observer. And earlier, the first article I read was by his wife, Gwen Brake. They make a formidable team. Now I'd like to read something that I've read before. I read it back in the fall. When this fellow who wrote this was a sophomore at Sunset High School in Beaverton. So I'm assuming that as at the end of the summer, he will be a junior. His name is Grant Robertson. And as I said, he attends Sunset High School in Beaverton. And he wrote this article called Occupy Bastille. And I'm sure most of you are aware that Saturday is Bastille Day. So that's why I'm reading it now. In the late 18th century, the French were in deep financial debt because they were funding the American Revolution, as well as fighting their own wars with Great Britain. To pay for the costs of these wars, the Third Estate, or 99% of the French population, was hit hard by unfair taxation systems that allowed the king, members of the Catholic Church, and the nobles, the richest landowners in the country, to pay virtually no taxes at all. After many years living under this inequitable taxing structure, many citizens got fed up and pushed for change. Protests erupted in cities and towns all over France, criticizing the government, requesting modifications in the tax regime, and demanding reductions to the outrageous price of basic food items such as bread. They protested for months, starting out rowdy and getting progressively more violent. As tensions grew, the king convened the Estates General, which included the nobles, the clergy, and 200 of the most prosperous, intelligent members of the Third Estate to represent the common people. They were to propose adjustments to the taxation system in France. After meeting once, they came to the conclusion that only the clergy, the nobles, and themselves would vote, leaving the king out of the equation. The king felt slighted about being excluded and was believed to have locked the doors where the Estates General would meet in the morning. This outraged the 200, and they decided to meet instead in a nearby tennis court, where later that day they took the tennis court oath, vowing to stand their ground until a new constitution for France was written. The defiance displayed by these individuals sparked a flame in the 99%, and the once separate dissenters came together, forming massive violent protests. Houses and bakeries were robbed. Policemen were killed, their heads carried high on pikes. Finally, citizens took over the Bastille, a large prison and storehouse for gunpowder, killing every guard inside and burning it to the ground. Events leading up to the French Revolution parallel the social and economic concerns we are facing in our country today. In modern America, as in historic France, an unequal tax system, in which the middle class pays more effective taxes than the rich, has created a barrier of wealth between the rich and the poor. In part because of this system, middle-class citizens today feel little hope of reaching the desired upper income tier, much like the Third Estate felt going into the French Revolution. Today, America also finds itself in a deep pit of debt caused in large part by the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Even more alarming, the public debt in France in 1791 was $2,028 per person in 2011 dollars. But in the United States today, it's a whopping $48,000 per person. Right now, the Occupy movement is growing. People leave their homes every day to participate in protests in cities and towns across America, criticizing a dysfunctional government and corporate greed. How long might it be until the growing mass of protesters become tired of sitting in parks day after day being ignored? Is our generation going to experience a new American Revolution? The answer lies just beneath the surface, but only in time will it emerge. And that was Occupy Bastille by Grant Robertson, who will be a junior, I surmise, at Sunset High School at the beginning of the next school year in a couple of months. Otherwise, I hope he's, I guess, protesting this, spending his summer protesting. Well, now I'd like to read a bit of testimony. And it's from a statement read in court by Tariq Mehana, a 29-year-old Massachusetts man who this past April was sentenced to 17 and a half years in prison on charges including materially supporting terrorism for offenses such as translating and posting Al-Qaeda propaganda online. And it's called Son of Liberty. I was born and raised right here in America. This angers many people. How can an American believe the things I believe, take the positions I take? In more ways than one, it's because of America that I am who I am. When I was six, I began putting together a massive collection of comic books. Batman implanted a concept in my mind, a paradigm as to how the world is set up, that there are oppressors, there are the oppressed, and there are those who step up to defend the oppressed. Throughout my childhood, I gravitated toward any book that reflected that paradigm. Uncle Tom's Cabin, the autobiography of Malcolm X, even The Catcher in the Rye. By the time I began high school and took a history class, I was learning just how real that paradigm is. I learned about the Native Americans and what befell them at the hands of European settlers. I learned about how the descendants of those European settlers were in turn oppressed under the tyranny of King George III. I read about Paul Revere, Tom Paine, and how Americans became an armed insurgency against British forces, an insurgency we now celebrate as the American Revolutionary War. I learned about the fight against slavery in this country and the struggles of the labor unions, working class, and poor. I learned about the civil rights struggle. For all the historical figures I learned about, one stood out above the rest. I was impressed by many things about Malcolm X, but above all, I was fascinated by his transformation. I don't know if you've seen the movie Malcolm X by Spike Lee. It's over 3 hours long, and the Malcolm at the beginning is different from the Malcolm at the end. He starts off as an illiterate criminal, but ends up a husband, a father, a protective and eloquent leader, a disciplined Muslim, performing the Hajj in Mecca, and finally, a martyr. Malcolm's life taught me that Islam is not something inherited. It's not a culture or ethnicity. It's a way of life, a state of mind anyone can choose, no matter where he comes from or how he was raised. Since there is no priesthood, I could directly and immediately begin digging into the texts of the Quran and the teachings of Prophet Muhammad. The more I learned, the more I valued Islam like a piece of gold. With that, my attention turned to what was happening to other Muslims in different parts of the world. And everywhere I looked, I saw the powers that be trying to destroy what I loved. I learned what the Soviets had done to the Muslims of Afghanistan. I learned what the Serbs had done to the Muslims of Bosnia. I learned what the Russians were doing to the Muslims of Chechnya. I learned what Israel had done in Lebanon and what it continues to do in Palestine, with the full backing of the United States. I learned what America itself was doing to Muslims. I learned about the Gulf War and depleted uranium bombs. I learned about the American-led sanctions that prevented food, medicine, and medical equipment from entering Iraq, and how, according to the United Nations, over 500,000 children perished as a result. I remember a clip from a 60 Minutes interview of Madeleine Albright in which she expressed her view that these dead children were, quote, worth it. I watched on September 11 as a group of people felt driven to hijack airplanes and fly them into buildings from their outrage at the deaths of these children. I watched as America attacked and invaded Iraq. I saw the effects of shock and awe in the opening days of the invasion, the children in hospital wards with shrapnel from American missiles sticking out of their foreheads. I learned about the town of Haditha, where 24 Muslims, including a 76-year-old man in a wheelchair, women, and even toddlers, were shot up by U.S. Marines. I learned about Abir Qasim al-Janabi, a 14-year-old Iraqi girl, gang-raped by five American soldiers, who then shot her and her family and set fire to the corpses. These are just the stories that make it to the headlines. I mentioned Paul Revere. When he jumped on a horse and went on his midnight ride, it was to warn the people that the British were marching to Lexington to arrest Sam Adams and John Hancock, then on to Concord to confiscate the weapons stored there by the Minutemen. By the time they got to Concord, they found the Minutemen waiting for them, weapons in hand. From that battle came the American Revolution. There is an Arabic word to describe what those Minutemen did that day. It was a word repeated many times in this courtroom. That word is jihad. And that was Son of Liberty by Tariq Mehana. And it was testimony he made, I'm sure, following his conviction for 17 and a half years in Massachusetts. I remember in Vietnam, a squad of Marines that were sent to pick up what they called a Viet Cong whore. And they went into this village, found her, all of them raped her and shot her, then lined up about 10 villagers, shot them, and then set fire to them, and then later, coming back with an officer, decided to scatter them and make the claim that they had ambushed them, and these are old men and women. And I saw the bodies, and the woman did survive, crawled to another village, and the village chief raised a real stink with the Marine Corps, and then these men of this one squad all went to Portsmouth, to the brig, including the squad leader, who was a devout Christian, and all he did was kneel and pray while his squad went on and did what they did. So when I read this testimony, talking about the 14-year-old Iraqi girl gang raped by the American soldiers, then shot her and her family, and set fire to the corpses. I immediately thought of that, and that was in the summer of 1966, just north of Chulai, which we as Marines in those days had before the Army took it over. And among those people who took it over was Lieutenant William Calley of the AmeriCal. And of course, we all knew who William Calley was, Mili. And this testimony appeared in the Harper's Magazine, July 2012, the part about Tariq and his being more or less an American patriot, a son of liberty. And this has been Michael McCusker. This is the 12th of July, the birthday, the 71st birthday of a fellow I grew up with, Frank Jerry Gudgel. I have no idea if he's still alive, but or within listening range and on the computer. But happy birthday, Gudgel. And this has been Michael McCusker. I suppose I'll be here next Thursday, which will be the 19th of July, exactly a month before I turn 71. And I will probably read some things about my newspaper, because the next day would be its 33rd anniversary, if indeed it were still being published. And of course, that was 33 years, the life of the Messiah that we believe in. He died at that age. So if indeed the sky doesn't fall on me, or I fall into the river and find myself stroking outside the bar, if a truck doesn't run me over, or one of those high-flying drones that we seem to be getting into our skies very soon without our approval, or they did hold a public meeting, but I don't see that there's ever going to be a vote on it, or that any of the councils are going to have anything to say about it. So if one of those doesn't fall down and incinerate me, I'll probably be here next Thursday. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.